I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
I'm Brigitte Noël, investigative reporter for Québécois in Montreal. I'm your guest host for today. With me is Martin Patriquin, freelancer whose work has been published in the New York Times, in Vice, The Guardian, The Globe and Mail, just to name a few. We're recording in my living room in Montreal. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
So today we're going to be talking about the Canadian government's media bailouts and Doug Ford's war on Ontario Francophones. This episode of Shortcuts is brought to you by Shelby Ray Peterson, Colin Tu, Corwin Head, Weldon Penner, Mary Lilly, Ian Edick, Jamie Selleck, and Ben Webster.
My name is Ben Webster. I live in Kitchener. I'm a professor at the University of Waterloo. I'm a relatively new resident of Canada, so I support Canada Land because I find it to be such a great resource for finding out about this crazy country of ours.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software. A quick question for all you freelancers. If you could reclaim up to 192 hours a year of your time, would you do it? Well, FreshBooks makes that a possibility by simplifying tasks like invoicing, tracking expenses, getting paid online, all the fun stuff. FreshBooks has drastically reduced the time it takes for over 5 million people to deal with their paperwork. What's more, the FreshBooks platform has been rebuilt from the ground up. They've taken simplicity and speed to an entirely new level and added powerful new features. If you're doing the math, 192 hours works out to 2 working days a month. Perhaps more importantly, when tax season rolls around, you'll find tidy summaries of your expense reports, your invoice details, your sales tax summaries, and a lot more. If you're a freelancer listening to this and you're not using FreshBooks yet, why not give it a shot? They're offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to Canada Land listeners. Just go to freshbooks.com/CanadaLand and enter Canada Land in the How Did You Hear About Us section. So last week, the federal government announced it would be allocating $595 million to bailing out the news media. This will be rolled out over 5 years in the form of tax credits, incentives. Finance Minister Bill Morneau explained that this was to protect the vital role that independent news media plays in our democracy, in our communities. And I mean, sure, good. It's important to protect our democracy. As a journalist, I'd love to see fewer layoffs and not constantly feel like my industry is in dire straits. But this money is a complicated gift for a lot of reasons. We'll get to those. But first, can we break it down? Can you tell us about the mechanics of this project, this legislation?
So the 1,000-foot view of it is basically exactly what you just said, that the federal government has sort of watched, like everyone else, the news media in Canada sort of go through sort of dry heaves of layoffs and flitting from one thing to another in an attempt to sort of cover off the fact that they are simply not selling ads to the point that they were before, and they want to help out, because if they don't help out, we're going to see a lot more of exactly what you just said. I think it's that simple.
So we're talking about refundable tax credits to support labor costs, temporary 10% or 15% rather credit for people who get digital news subscriptions. Then we have this aspect where nonprofit media will be allowed to apply for charitable status.
That's right. Yeah. So nonprofit status, which is an interesting one, because if you think about it way, way back in the day, and this is like 15, 20 years ago when I was sort of getting into it, I worked for Maisonneuve magazine. I did a piece for Maisonneuve magazine and Walrus magazine.
Right.
And the business model for them, they quickly figured out, was their ability to get nonprofit status. So even 15 years ago, before, you know, when this sort of the stuff that we're talking about now, that is to say Facebook, Google, eating all the ad revenue and the decline in print media, the business model for two of Canada's best magazines was sort of predicated on getting nonprofit status. The writing was on the wall that long ago.
Well, and this is something that's pretty big in the States. I mean, Neiman Lab states that in the U.S., nonprofit status for news organization has been pretty lucrative. That sector reaches almost $350 million in total revenue. So are we late to this party?
I think so. I mean, the
why wasn't it possible?
I don't know. Lack of imagination. The fact that, again, you know, legacy media, and I don't really like that term because everybody uses it, but it is slow moving. And then always the belief was that, you know, we can somehow turn this around. We were making money for so long doing one very simple thing, that is to say, selling space in our newspapers for money and then using that money to pay for the more interesting stuff in between those ads. We were doing that for so long. We have to be able to use that model and make money on it somehow. And I mean, you know, to the media critic's point, the one that's out there a lot is that basically the law of diminishing returns hasn't really shaken the foundations of that. It's still very much believed that newspapers have to be able to make money. Or in the case of something like, I mean, you could argue the Globe and Mail, you almost have like a benevolent dictator of an owner who, you know, and the Aspers got into this in the mid-2000s, got into newspapers and believed that they would, you know, support a newspaper like the National Post, even though it lost money or didn't make very much money, depending on what you're talking about, simply because they like to have the national voice. They like to have influence within the sort of national conversation. And those are the sort of two models. But, you know, I mean, there's another aspect of it too, and it's one thing that we haven't talked about very much, is, you know, the largest newspaper chain in the country, Post Media, they have assets within that chain, and the one that I know most of is because I write for them is the Gazette. The Gazette does quite well. The Gazette makes a lot of money, and yet they're going through the exact same layoffs as anyone else. The reason being is because they have, loans and payment guarantees that they have to make to a parent company, to a hedge fund that owns them, unfortunately.
So, I mean, this money is a welcome gift for some, but it's heavily criticized by many in the industry. Can you talk about some of the criticism that it's been getting?
Yeah, I mean, I'm conflicted about it. I had a conversation with a guy a few years ago and, you know, sort of bemoaning the whole aspect of media and everything like that. And he sort of flipped it on my argument on its head and sort of said, you know, there's never been a better time to be in journalism because there are so many modes of telling a story. There's so many ways to get your stuff that you're writing or, you know, blogging or, you know, podcasting or what have you out to human beings. And beyond that, the market for it, like there's such a demand for media now. More so, I would argue, than before.
But are people willing to pay for it?
This is the problem.
Yeah.
It's not only a question. Well, I mean, that's one of our issues, is that we gave it away for free. Mm-hmm. We gave it away for free right from the get-go because we panicked. And we thought, well, what we do is so important that if we give it away for free to give people a taste, they'll come crawling back, which is like...
Yeah. In a text that you recently wrote, you made an analogy to crack.
Yeah, it's like the crack dealer. Crack dealer always, when they open, go get into a new market, they give their shit away for free with the idea that when they start charging for it, people are going to be addicted and they'll come back.
People did not get addicted.
People did not get addicted. They moved elsewhere because someone else was always giving it away. You know what the interesting thing is? One of the interesting points, I actually was talking to Ken White not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Ken White bought the former publisher of Maclean's. He worked at Rogers forever.
Your former boss.
My former boss. Yes, my former. That's true. He's my former boss. A very, very, very smart guy. A great writer. And I called him up and I go, well, you're insane. You're buying a book publisher. What, you know, why are you investing in print and all this kind of thing? And he made a point that I hadn't really thought about, was that contrary to what the media, print media has done or did at the outset of the sort of panic when everything was moving online, the book industry never gave away their product for free. They never, ever did. So if you look at book publishers, even when they moved into, you know, it's not PDFs, but, you know, into tablets and electronic editions of books and stuff like that, the price difference didn't go from whatever you pay for a hardcover, $29, to say, you know, $3 for whatever they might have charged for something that, you know, you didn't have to pay for ink, you didn't have to pay for paper, you didn't have to pay for shipping. The difference was actually closer to like $10, you know, so basically instead of paying 29, you were paying 19. So they never really gave their product away for free. And lo and behold, he's like, well, you know, there's a market for our stuff. People still want to read books, regardless of what format we put them out is. The difference between books and printed media, that is to say news media, is that we never gave it away for free.
So I have a tweet in front of me from Ken White, actually, on this bailout. And he wrote, "This initiative is deplorable. It will undermine the credibility of all Canadian news media by its very existence." What do you think of that?
There's a lot of truth to that.
Because, I mean, we're going into an election year. There's something particular about taking money from the very people we're meant to be holding accountable.
Yeah.
Are we being wooed in exchange for positive coverage?
To be perfectly honest, I don't think we are. I don't think anybody would think that. Or pardon me, I don't think anybody within the industry thinks that, oh, because we're getting this, that we're going to have to give positive coverage to X. The issue is a problem of perception.
Right.
Is people thinking that that might be the case. And as anybody knows, as you know in campaigns, as you know in politics, is that perception is reality. And look, I don't begrudge that point of view. I think it's very, very valid. Whether or not we actually do it doesn't actually really matter. It's what people believe. And if all of a sudden I'm getting $100 million or what have you from the Canadian government as though we were, you know, a car company or something like that, you can totally understand that. Because why do politicians bail out companies like GM, like the Harper government did and the Liberal government did before that? They do it for votes. So, you know, if you apply the same analogy to us,
yeah,
it's almost like you can understand why people would think that.
There's also the question of who gets to decide who gets the bailout, who doesn't. I mean, the government said it's going to establish a quote-unquote independent panel of journalists. Is that problematic?
It's problematic for so many reasons. We're incestuous. Everybody knows each other. Everybody has personal grudges against, you know, certain media entities. And, you know, we're it's the aftermath of a war out there for a lot of journalists. You know, there's been so many layoffs. There's so much bitterness carried by so many people. Like, how can you possibly think that they're going to be indifferent and, you know, as to who gets this money?
Yeah. And will this help organizations become more diverse, better employers? Because that's been a push as well.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the other thing, so that's if you ask journalists. The other thing about asking journalists to do this, it's sort of the same thing of asking your average human being as to who should be senator. That's the Liberals. The Liberals did that with the senators, sort of depoliticizing the senators that have been named. But I mean, they're independent senators in name only. A lot of them are pretty good liberals, let's be perfectly honest. And again, I'm not saying that that's necessarily going to happen with the journalists who pick to who this money goes to. But again, it's the same thing. Is it a question of perception? If that is the perception of the majority of people out there, that journalists are sort of rewarding or punishing the media entities that this money goes to based on their own personal experiences or their own personal biases, et cetera, that's a problem.
Some independent media organizations, some critics of this bailout think this is rewarding mediocrity. I mean, this podcast's mm-hmm. usual host, Jesse Brown, has been quite vocal about this. You've written about it yourself. Do you think we're disincentivizing innovation? What is this doing?
I mean, as far as rewarding, the term I use was like rewarding failure.
Yeah.
And I just sort of reflected on how exactly the media industry, the news media, the print, I'm going to be very specific here, the printed news media in Canada and elsewhere reacted to the whole online aspect, right? when this started, when I was just getting into the industry, like, you know, 18 years ago, the threat back then was convergence, you know, Time, AOL, these big companies swallowing up media companies to sort of make them almost like cogs and convergence wheels, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And people freaking out about that. That didn't turn out to be a problem, but the fear was instructive because, you know, there was obviously with this patente, as they say in French, of the internet, something was going to come and eat our lunch. And that obviously happened. You know, I still remember the first time I saw Craigslist, the San Francisco-based sort of like classified ads thing. And I was just, the scope of it didn't grasp me. I'm just like, wow, you can just do this and nobody asks you for money. You don't have to give your credit card. You don't really have to give your name. You can just put it on the internet and someone's going to come get it. You know, that turned out to be a massive, massive hit to newspapers because they made a massive amount of money on classifieds. And then pieces of our business just started going out that way. And how did we react? How did, you know, the news media react? Well, you know, the bosses still got paid a lot of money. The difference being was that the companies they were running were making, you know, successively less and less money, and they panicked. So they all did sort of the same thing. We pivoted to podcasts and video. We wrote long, we wrote short, we did everything possible. You know, sort of,
well, there have been so many attempts.
So many attempts, exactly. So many attempts to evolve, and nothing worked. And now in the real world, in a real sort of proper capitalism, when that happens, you turf the people that are there and you come in with new fresh ideas. That, as far as I can tell, that hasn't really happened in anywhere. Partially because the management didn't know what to do, but also because people like, you know, editors in chief, all the way down to lowly peons like myself, didn't know exactly what to do about it. You know, we didn't know what are we? We write stories that we want people to read, but we didn't really have any idea of how exactly to get beyond putting them on paper and sending them in Canada, by way of Canada Post, to everybody out there.
So I'm just reading one of Jesse's tweets here. He says that it's going to be like we hit freeze on the Canadian news media at a historic low point, locking in mediocrity indefinitely. It's a bit harsh, I think. What do you think?
I mean, he's right. Yeah, it is a bit harsh. The one thing I would say is that the people running the majority of like the people way up top running the majority of media in this country, and it is very uber concentrated, are old school media types. They haven't gone anywhere.
Is this a wake up call, or is this going to make them settle in, be more comfortable?
Well, you just have to judge by the reaction.
Yeah.
You know, they're pretty happy with this.
So you mentioned this earlier, but I want to get back to it. Foreign companies are now getting the bulk of our advertising dollars. Facebook and Google alone represent 70% of this country's online ad revenue.
Yeah.
What do we do with them? There's been talking about getting them to pay a journalist tax. How do you interpret them as content publishers now?
Right. They're slippery. Are they actual media companies?
Yeah.
And they're a bit like Uber, you know, they say that, oh no, our drivers aren't employees, they're independent contractors. And so they sort of game the system. I literally have absolutely no idea.
No, we'd been getting,
I don't,
we'd
don't,
make a lot of money if we had the
I don't,
answers
I don't
to that.
Know what the answer is to that. Cause I mean, on the one hand, yeah, sure. They're a bit blood sucking and a bit, that's
understatement.
But I mean, it goes back to what my friend told me years and years ago about, you know, the advent of internet for journalism. It's such a great opportunity. Facebook gives you massive amounts of exposure. Google gives you massive amounts of exposure as a writer, as someone who wants to get their stuff out.
For free. Right. But right. Do you think they're considered publishers in that sense then?
Depends on what the definition is slippery depending on what the circumstances are. That they would argue that they are not. They are conveyors. But again, we're using old terms to try to define something that is completely new.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to move over to some tweets that we have collected on this matter. I have here
collecting
tweets.
Welcome
in my
2018
tweet collection. Do I sound old? Is that a word? Okay. So this is a cynical tweet from Dan Dalmar. A free exchange of ideas between a PMO brandishing $600 million and a struggling industry whose raison d'être is to hold government to account. What could possibly go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of tweets about how this, you know, what role this will play in pushing organizations to be more diverse. Here we have Media Indigena saying we will have to checklist to see how many Indigenous newspapers will qualify. Karen K. Ho asking, do you think the new financial support from Ottawa to Canadian journalism will finally make it more diverse or what? Along with a reminder that the last time a study was done on something like this was in 2004 and people of color made up 3.4% of newsroom staff in Canada. She calls that abysmal. Then we have a comment from Trudeau's senior political advisor, Gerald Butts. Honest question, why were the many millions of public dollars that used to be spent on government advertising in newspapers okay, but this transparent policy change is deplorable? And that was in response to that Ken White tweet that I read you earlier.
Like he's right in the sense that, yes, government advertising, like all advertising, used to go by way of newspapers, and now they don't. The difference is, with all due respect to Mr. Butts, is that that was a business transaction. Ergo, it began and ended when money was exchanged and the ad was printed. That isn't the case with the bailout. To compare bailout to an advertising is sort of like apples to oranges.
Oh, and another interesting one, Drake Fenton. I'll be interested to see if this applies to non-Canadian organizations that produce Canadian content. Does the organization have to be digital only, or would the New York Times count? Because we know they've been making inroads in Canada.
The New York Times one is really interesting.
Yeah.
I've done a few things for the New York Times in the past, and my ex-editor, who's no longer there, I was talking to about it one day, and he was talking about the Canadian media landscape and sort of the success of the New York Times here in Canada. Now, this is before they Ian Austin's been in Ottawa for a long, long time, but this is before they hired anybody in Toronto or in Montreal. And I was asking him about it, and he goes, it's absolutely incredible the number of subscriptions, digital subscriptions to the New York Times. That is to say, what we now know is subscriptions, because you can't, I mean, you can buy the paper here, I suppose, but the vast majority, the vast, vast, vast majority are digital subscriptions. In Canada, is exponentially large to our population. That is to say, people in Canada are buying the New York Times like crazy, and we are scurrying to get Canadian content in there for this very reason. And I go, well, why do you think that is? And he goes, it's because of the demise of the media in Canada. He says there are less.
That's grim.
Yeah, he said. So the New York Times, that is the extent to which not only companies like Facebook and Google and all those awful guys are eating our lunch, but the New York Times is actually coming in and sees space in the Canadian media landscape in the wake of all these of downsizing, of massive layoffs, of closing of titles, and say, we can do something in here. And lo and behold, that is exactly what they're doing. One of the very few examples of a successful transition from print to digital, that is to say the New York Times company, is basically making a clinic here in Canada.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses. But we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand.
Okay, Martin, it's time for the section of the show that we call Duly Noted. Do you have anything to duly note?
Transcontinental, big media company.
What are they doing?
They're massive.
Yeah.
impervious to even the smallest little man. Except if that smallest little man wants to stop getting their freaking poobly sacks. What do they call them in English Canada? It's like
bag full of flyers.
Bag full of flyers delivered to their house. So he basically had a thing that said you want to opt in instead of opting out, right? And so he had a campaign to sort of get this going because, look, you know, it's a lot of resources that go into publishing these things or, you know.
Well, paper. He thinks it's polluting. He thinks polluting.
Well, exactly. So it's a waste of energy and these things just go straight into the trash. So, you know, like a lot of people, he just tried to perpetuate this with his neighbors and what have you. And Transcon sent a mise en demeure, which is a very nice French sounding term, which doesn't translate well into English, which means letter of demand, basically saying, stop doing this or else.
David and Goliath,
yeah.
So they made
media companies, man. You're not doing yourself any favors. Don't they know there's a bailout coming?
Duly noted. I'm going to take this opportunity to duly note my favorite Montreal-based Instagram account. Do you know Fuck No MTL?
I don't.
Do you follow them?
Fuck No MTL? I don't. Yeah, Instagram, I don't do it. I don't do Facebook or Instagram.
You should do it just for this. So it's
Twitter slut.
Twitter slut. Collecting tweets?
I collect tweets.
All day, all night. Okay, so Fuck No MTL is a mashup of weird things happening in the city. It's mostly construction chaos, weird things spotted on garbage day or in the metro, bagels, orange construction cones. But it also has this gonzo journalist or like whistleblower quality to it. If you want to find out more about funny or sometimes worrisome things happening in Montreal, this is the account for you.
Fuck No Montreal. At Fuck No Montreal.
At Fuck No MTL.
Est-ce qu'on sait, do we know who runs it?
It's anonymous.
Anonymous?
I mean, I do, but...
Do you? Because you're a journalist in the know.
I'm an investigative journalist.
There you go. Duly noted.
Moving on to our next topic, Francophobia. The Coles notes of what happened on November 15th at 5.04 p.m. specifically.
Wow.
Ontario Finance Minister Vic Fedeli delivered the fall economic statement, which gave us an idea of how Doug Ford's progressive conservatives would tackle the province's $15 billion deficit. So among the quote-unquote efficiencies were several cuts affecting the province's 600,000 or so francophones. Gone was the plan to build the province's first francophone-only university in the Toronto region. Out went the office of the French Language Services Commissioner. We've since also learned that he's cut a $3 million subsidy to Nouvelle-Seine, which is a francophone arts center in Ottawa, and which could mean the closure of this institution. He's also shutting down the province's only three French language educational magazines, which were financed by the federal, but the province gets to decide where that money goes, and so they've been ordered to stop printing.
Right.
As a Franco-Ontarian, which I am, this feels like an attack on my culture. What does it look like to you?
It is that, obviously. He basically yada-yada'd the rights of, you know, the number of Franco-Ontarians is a sticky thing. It's between 550 and 600,000. So he, you know, did that to a historical minority in Ontario, and it's awful. That said, he's a populist politician, and he's very, you know, adept at political cynicism. And he said, look, we have all this money going to a small population, and let's be perfectly honest, that small population doesn't vote for me. Look where the Francophones are in Ontario.
Well, he didn't say that, but...
This is the political calculation he made. But more than that, I don't think it's Francophobia, perfectly honestly. I honestly, because I think that word is thrown around being here in Quebec, it's thrown around so much that it sort of loses its meaning. What I will say about what he did was that he's indifferent to it. He's perfectly oblivious and indifferent to the French.
He doesn't understand to the French fact in Ontario.
He doesn't care. He's like Donald Trump, like in that sense. And I'm not comparing him to Donald Trump, but I mean Donald Trump is just beyond actual hatred and enmity. I think he's oblivious to it.
Well, because let's break it down mathematically. This isn't really a cost-saving measure, according to a lot of experts who've analyzed this. The university represents about $10 million a year spread out over 7 years, $11 million, sorry.
Plus they got to build it.
Well, yeah, but that budget is 0.1% of the total higher education budget, according to Zian Adan, who's the president of the university's governing council.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
It's a line item. But to him, that's the whole point, is that you strike out stuff in a budget that you think you can do without. And again, I come back to what I said before. He doesn't understand French. He probably doesn't know very many French, but he's from fucking Etobicoke, for Christ. There's no French people in Etobicoke. He's never been outside there, hardly. And so what does he care? And the proof positive is the fact that he backed down on some of this stuff anyway last week.
Not really.
He backed down on the French Languages Commissioner.
But it's still going to be under the ombudsman. I mean, it's a symbolic back down. It's not really changing much.
Right. But his whole thing was that, remember the quote that he gave to CBC right after he did? He says, like, look, I love French. I love Fritalian. I love everything. But we're broke. So, you know, it's nothing personal. Then lo and behold, it was personal because he got a huge amount of pushback from people. And it sort of laid waste a little bit to the idea that's perpetuated here in Quebec, is that Francophones outside of the borders of Quebec are, you know, basically like a voiceless rump.
The ones that existed,
yes, their numbers are dwindling, but also the fact that the powerlessness of them.
But their numbers are not dwindling. Francophones in Ontario are actually on the rise. I mean, because our population is increasing.
It's on the rise, but it's not as fast as the rest of the population.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing as Francophones here in Quebec.
Let's talk about media coverage of this story. You kind of briefly touched upon it. We live in Quebec. I work in French media, and I feel like the outrage was immediate here. Politicians spoke out, pundits, everybody was up in arms. And there was this solidarity among Francophones. There's been criticism that Anglophone media outside of Quebec, because Anglo media here, were also quick to condemn the move. You notably wrote a piece for the Gazette. The paper's editorial board spoke out as well.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Anglo media's response outside of Quebec?
It's the same as Ford. It's sort of like bafflement and indifference when it comes to the Francophones. The idea that there's a French fact outside of the borders of Quebec, if it doesn't involve borders, well, first of all, French for people in Toronto-based media is, you know, it happens in Quebec, and what, you know, occasionally it'll pop up if, you know, someone calls someone a racist or whatever. And then, so that's one step of detachment. There's an even a further step of detachment when you talk about Francophones that live outside Quebec, because that just doesn't make any sense to anyone. So I think the reaction within the Toronto-based media was just that, was just like, oh, well, that's weird. And then when people like myself and people like Patrick Lagacé from La Presse wrote what they wrote.
Let's talk about Patrick Lagacé.
Yeah, so he basically said, you know, where's the outrage?
He is one of the most respected columnists in the province, writes in French typically, but wrote exceptionally a column in English calling out Anglophone media
For having talked about this.
For not having talked about this.
Exactly. So lo and behold, everybody started publishing pieces after that. The Globe and Mail came out with a piece within like 3 hours of that.
Yeah, but some people had written columns. There had been, Rick Gibbons wrote in the Ottawa Sun, you know, he was critical of Ford's cuts. Didn't say anything about the Francophone University, but was really critical about the cuts to the office.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some pundits speaking out about
Chantal Hébert. Patrick mentioned that. Fellow Franco-Ontarian, as far as I know.
She's from Southern Ontario. Globe published a column titled Franco. Like, I just want to point out that there were some columns. There was some solidarity from Anglo media. As a Franco-Ontarian, I didn't feel like it was that radio silence as it's been described. I did feel that a lot of people got involved. I do feel that some...
I think Patrick's point...
He might have triggered much of it.
I think he triggered some of it for sure. But also the point, I mean, and it's a bit boiteuse. What's boiteuse in English? Boiteuse, it's a bit... It doesn't... The comparison doesn't quite fit the idea that, you know, why didn't Maclean's put out a cover of Ontario, the most Francophobic province in Canada and all this kind of stuff? Well, I was like, well, this is one incident. It happened now. Give it... You know, space to breathe. Ford ended up backing down on some of this stuff. B, Maclean's is a monthly that has like three reporters and a ferret running the place right now. It's time. Yeah. I mean, not to denigrate what Maclean's is doing at all, because there's people there that I really, really admire.
Yeah.
But times are tough. The idea that the Maclean's would sort of pivot and all of a sudden come out with this, you know, manufactured outrage within 48 hours of this happening is patently absurd.
Mm. Let's talk about political reaction to this. Let's talk about Carolyn Mulroney and her
and she didn't say a
lack
word.
Of reaction.
I think I counted 10 words or something that she said about the whole thing in the space of a week and a half.
Here I have one of her sentences translated roughly. She said, "If Francophones are worried, I'm listening. I'm committed to working every day to advance the Franco-Ontarian cause."
That's more than 10 words.
More than 10 words. Didn't sit well with her Francophone public.
No. And I mean, the thing that I touched on it before, the thing that really that I saw in the whole thing was that it's really laid waste to the idea that Franco-Ontarians and Francophones outside of Quebec don't have any political pull is patently absurd. If you look at where Justin Trudeau is coming from, his dad was one of the original people who, you know, instituted official bilingualism specifically because he believed in Francophone. He believed that there was and this is politically, you know, cynical on his part, but that Francophones outside Quebec were important for them for vote as a voting base, but also very, very important in terms of, like, you know, the country's history and all this kinds of stuff, and that they must be supported. And so Trudeau is, his son is basically coming at it exactly the same way. So the idea that Franco-Ontarians are don't have a say isn't, I don't think, is necessarily true. And I think the last week in the wake of Ford's decision demonstrative of that.
Yeah. So the real standout in all this for me and for many people has been PC MPP Amanda Simard, who is a Franco-Ontarian from Glengarry, Prescott, Russell. She broke ranks with her party to speak out against these cuts. What do you think of what she's doing? What do you think? Where do you think this is heading?
I mean, that's a very interesting point. So the Toronto Star came out with a story this week that talked about how a bunch of MPPs within the Conservative Party are thinking of bolting.
Yeah, crossing the floor.
Crossing the floor. I think if it was a normal, quote unquote, normal government that had a sort of hold on its own members and its own members of, what is it called in Ontario? MPPs?
Yeah.
Member of Provincial Parliament. That she would have suffered some sort of consequences for doing what she did. She, when the finance minister got up and talked and everybody started clapping, she sat and was very obvious and not clapping for any of this kind of
stuff. And then she clapped for the NDP.
And then she clapped for the NDP. That's right. So I think in a normal world, you know, she would have suffered some sort of consequences for that. She didn't. And in fact, Ford, in his comeback, in his crawlback, pardon me, on all of this, I don't think he mentioned her necessarily by name, but all of a sudden, Carolyn Mulroney was superstar cabinet minister. I mean, really, like, good for her, but also, you know, she was one of the few Conservative MPPs that is elected in an area where there's a significant Francophone population. Prescott Russell's, there's a lot. It's basically an exurb of Ottawa, right?
Yeah, and they've always voted Liberal. I think this is the first time in years that they elect a PC member. So
yeah.
On Saturday, Francophone and Francophile groups across the province have planned protests in about 40 different regions. As we record these words, federal party leaders are meeting in Ottawa to chat about the future of Francophone Canadians, which I think is a first. So yeah, I guess we'll sit back and see what's going to happen.
Yeah, the rumblings that I heard was that the federal government, Liberal federal government, is trying to cobble together a way to build that Francophone University in Toronto, and that the agreement that they would have with Ontario was that they would provide the funds to build it, but that Ontario would have to fund it year per year. That's huge. Listen, I mean, not to be a glass half full on all of this, but I mean, a week ago, Francophones in Ontario were a put upon minority group. All of a sudden, they've got all this backing. That's pretty good.
As a Franco-Ontarian, I think it's been so heartwarming to see this community and this support and this kind of solidarity around the French cause. And it's been lovely to be recognized.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, and it's a phenomenon that happens only outside of Quebec, because Quebec has language laws, that a huge number of English parents and English-speaking parents send their kids to bilingual schools or send their kids to French schools.
French schools are overflowing.
They're overflowing. In Ottawa, it's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
You know, people want their kids to learn this kind of thing. And that is this sort of Pierre Trudeau, dream, was the fact that French is actually flourishing outside of Quebec, which, as you point out, I don't think it's necessarily flourishing, but it's not the, what was it? What is it? Was it Rene Levesque that called them dead ducks?
Dead ducks.
Dead ducks.
We're not dead ducks.
We're not anywhere close to being dead ducks.
Thanks so much, Martin.
Thank you.
That's your Canada Land Shortcuts. Jesse Brown will return next week. If you haven't listened to it yet, check out the Thunder Bay podcast. The final episode just dropped this week. Full disclosure, I helped with some of the research on this project, and it truly was a fascinating investigation into some pretty troubling stories. Ryan, Jesse, and the Canada Land team did an amazing job putting it all together. Canada Land is on Twitter at Canada Land. Martin, where can people find you?
At Martin Patrickwin. So it's at MartinPatrickwin.
And you can find me on there as well at Bridge_Noel. That's BRIGE_Noel. You can find all of Canada Land's podcasts and reporting online at canadalandshow.com. This episode was produced by David Crosby. Canada Land's managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do, please support Canada Land at patreon.com/CanadaLand.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.